So tonight's talk is called Only Don't Know. And it's a very famous Zen teaching. And it comes from a teacher, Son Sanim, who is a Korean Zen master who was became very well known in the 80s. He lived in Providence. He started the Providence Zen Center, Providence, Rhode Island. And he was came over to the U.S. and worked in a, I think it was either a dry cleaners or a laundromat folding laundry. But he was a Zen master, and eventually he, you know, taught students and started a center and all that. And he was a very intense guy. I did one weekend retreat with him back in the early 80s, and typical Zen style, even though it was just a weekend retreat, we were getting up at like 3:30 in the morning and starting our meditation, and we were all doing the Zen nod in unison as a group practice. Not everybody, but a lot of us. And I was pretty new to practice, and I had no idea why we would get up that early to just keep sleeping in the upright posture. But that's very Zen style. He was known for, you know, being intense at times. He also had a really great sense of humor. One of his stories that was told to me by a friend of mine in the Tibetan tradition, Kalu Rinpoche was a very well-known Tibetan meditation master of the 20th century, and he's had many, many students go on three-year retreat under his guidance. And so there was some kind of meeting of the minds, kind of like Dharma combat situation scheduled, where Kalu Rinpoche would meet, one great master would meet this other great master from the Zen tradition, and they would have kind of Dharma dialogue or Dharma combat. And so Son Sanim starts off, you know, there's a big audience and they're sitting there, starts off by holding up an orange and saying, "What is this?" And Kalu Rinpoche just kind of looks at him, doesn't say anything. "What is this?" You know, very intense. And this goes on for a little while. And Kalu Rinpoche keeps looking at him, kind of bemused, and eventually turns to his translator and just says, "Don't they have oranges in Korea?" So, the meeting of the ultimate and the relative. We can get all trippy with our Dharma practice, you know. You know, what really is an orange? I mean, actually, when we really sit down and contemplate what an orange is, it's actually sort of confusing to really... You can't find the essence of an orange. You know, does an orange exist in its parts or apart from its parts? If you peel an orange, is it still an orange? If you think it is, then if you take out a slice of the orange, is it still an orange? If you keep taking out slices, when does it not an orange anymore? If an orange has seeds, is it an orange? If it doesn't have seeds, is it an orange? I mean, actually, you can't find orange. There's no such thing as an essence to anything. And that would be a kind of Dharma combat. But Kalu Rinpoche is like, well, don't they have oranges in Korea? So there's the ultimate truth. You can't find orange, and yet we can call it an orange, and we have a pretty good idea what that kind of means. So Son Sanim's sense of humor side is, you know, he had a lot of teaching about being very simple, letting mind and body be together. So when you're doing something, just do one thing. When sitting, just sit. When walking, just walk. When eating, just eat. And so I guess he lived at the Providence Zen Center. Other students lived there, and this is the 80s, so people are pretty new to Buddhism, being very earnest about their practice, of course. And so a student walks down into the dining hall, and there's Sonsa Nim sitting there eating his breakfast and reading the paper. So the student comes up to him and says, Master, I must say I'm kind of shocked, you know. You're not just eating, you're eating and reading. And without hesitating, Sonsa Nim looked up and said, when you eat and read, only eat and read. So in our cases, when you're driving and eating and looking at your text messages, only text, eat, and drive. Be very zen about it. Just joking around. So one of his main teachings to his students was only don't know. Only don't know. Only don't know. This is not about falling asleep at the wheel, you know. This is a very awake, very alive, very present way to be. Only don't know. So I wanted to talk about this topic of don't know mind and actually how incredibly helpful it is to be willing to not know what we don't know. It's very stressful. It's suffering to control what you can't control. That's suffering. It's also suffering to think you know something you actually don't know. It's actually very, we create a lot of suffering in our lives by thinking we know things we don't actually know. And the more we can orient and not know what we don't know, the more happy we become. Ironically, the less stressed we become, the more we sort of rest as presence and as beingness. And we're quite happy when we do that. But our need to know can be very useful, but it can also cause a lot of difficulty. So that's kind of the theme I'm going to talk about tonight. So it's really uncomfortable, isn't it, to sit with uncertainty, to not know, you know? And yet, it's the heart of the matter. Life is so uncertain. We just don't know. I mean, you know, one Dharma teacher says, anything can happen anytime. You know? My most recent thing is I'm just minding my own business, and I get an email from my stepmother that my dad's in the hospital. And one morning he just had a fall. And he's fine now, but he was in the ICU for 4 days just this last week. We're just bumping along in our lives, and things are happening. Do you remember where you were when 911 happened? You know? Things happen. Extremely surprising. And life is so uncertain and chaotic and complex that actually being able to surf uncertainty and be with uncertainty and be comfortable with uncertainty is a huge reality need. We really need to do this. And the good news is this is exactly what our practice is for. Our practice is exactly for being comfortable with uncertainty. So I'll keep unpacking that. I've quoted this recently. I think when I did the slideshow on my time in the monastery in Thailand, but one of the signs, I was in a monastery that was started by Ajahn Chah, who's a very famous Thai teacher and monk of the 20th century. He was Jack Kornfield's first main Dharma teacher, and I went over there as a anagarika, sort of a pre-novice monk for 3 months. I was still in robes, but I wasn't really fully ordained. But anyway, one of the signs, he had a lot of very famous sayings. He was a very wise being, but his students tacked up some of his sayings. He died in the 80s, but this monastery has continued, and it's mostly for Westerners. So there's various signs tacked up through the woods in this monastery of things he said. And one of the things he said is, any speech that ignores uncertainty is not the speech of the sage. Given the season we just went through, the political season, can you relate to that? There was a lot of very certain speech going on. And it's not very wise speech when it's really slanted and really certain. That's usually not acknowledging how much uncertainty is in life. But more and more and more, when, I mean, anything we want to know is just a click, a mouse click away. I mean, we can feel like we know a ton, or at least we can, you know, instantly know something very quickly about Paraguay or about, you know, the Magna Carta or whatever, right? I mean, we can just click it up and it shows right up on Wikipedia or whatever, and we're the instant expert. As long as we have our smartphone in front of us, we're pretty smart. And we think we know so much, and yet there's actually not very much we really know for sure. It's sort of immature in a way to think that we know so much. And as the joke goes, quick, hire a teenager while they still know everything. You remember that in yourself, being 17 or 18 and 19 and being so sure of how much you knew, and like kind of how idiotic so many other grown-ups in the world are? This is from Rick Hansen's Dharma Email Digest, Just One Thing. There's a story around this. A great scholar had a meeting with a wise person, a true sage, and the scholar asked the sage about the meaning of life. The sage said a few words about love and joy, paused to reflect a little bit, and then the scholar jumped in with a long discourse on Western and Eastern philosophy. When the scholar was finished, the sage proposed some tea, prepared it with care, and began pouring it slowly into the scholar's cup. Inch by inch, the tea rose. It approached the lip of the cup, and the sage kept pouring. It ran over the top of the cup and onto the table, and the sage still kept pouring. The scholar burst out, "What are you doing? You can't put more into a cup that's already full." The sage set down the teapot and said, "Exactly." When we're so full of what we think we know, we don't really let the world in anymore. We kind of obscure the world with all that we think we know. Sometimes what we think we know can really engage us and make us very inquisitive. So this is not to throw that out at all. But, you know, really, really notice in your life where you think you knew something and then reality pulled the rug out from under you and showed you that actually you, what you thought you knew actually was really blinding you to how the world is. So we learn this, and it's painful, and we learn it again and again. We think we know something, and it's usually some kind of pain that teaches us that actually there's a little bit of hubris going on. And so we do this, and we get wiser. And as we get wiser, we realize we know less and less. And it takes maturity to really admit this, but you know, don't you think you know less now than you knew when you were 19? Not quite so cocksure of yourself and what fools other people are. Maybe like, huh, maybe they have a perspective that I haven't quite entertained yet. Maybe I'll just listen. As we get older, we start to be more like that. And this is wisdom. It's humble and real and helpful to admit that we don't know so much. And it usually takes wrinkles to get wise. We probably all know young people in our lives, kids who seem sort of naturally wise, for most of us, it takes wrinkles. And in our culture, which is so deifying youth, and everything, I mean, I have friends who are in their 40s who pretty much, like in the advertising world, are basically obsolete. They're looking for other things because by the time you hit, you know, 40, 45, you're just kind of an old dude or an old gal. The advertising industry is driven by youth, and our culture is so driven by youth. We're very hard on our bodies that are just doing their thing and aging. And we're getting wise and then looking at our body and feeling like, oh, I'm saggy and wrinkly, and instead of like, wow, look at these wisdom badges that I'm advertising to the world with my wrinkles. And I don't know very much anymore. And I got these wrinkles to prove it. Our wrinkles are beautiful. They're our wisdom badges. So don't know mind. And I actually really want to relate this to the holidays since they're coming up. So I thought it would be helpful just to kind of maybe encourage you to take only don't know into the holidays. It's just one way of really taking your practice. And I'm going to talk about some ways that don't know mind could actually be really helpful when we're with family situations that might be nice or might be stressful or might be boring or however they are. Stuff comes up. So a natural point to just stop before getting into that and just see if any comments or questions or reflections you want to share right now, and then we'll take a break.
My favorite bumper sticker says, "Old guy, frequently wrong, never in doubt."
Did everyone hear? Oh, just for the mic. Old guy, frequently wrong, never in doubt. Cool. I actually want to talk about how our mindfulness practice can really help us be just like that. It doesn't help us be old, but it does help us with seeing when we're wrong and also not being in doubt so much. The more we're in our heads, the more doubtful we are. The more we're in our mindfulness practice, the less doubtful we are. Very interesting. So stay tuned.
Suggestions that go along with how to do that when the content is particularly difficult versus easy.
Well, I can think of situations with kids where you kind of feel like I got to know something. I can think of situations at work where you just feel like I got to know something. So, there are times where, you know, we got to just take our best shot. The trick is to act based on what we think we know, and not be attached to what we know. You know, that's sort of the trick. Because the less we're attached to what we know, if we're attached to what we know, then we're like the teacup that's already full. Nothing new can come in. But if we can really just juggle and use our knowledge to the best we can and be in a place where we can be so open to learning, then that's when don't know mind, can really meet what we do know. So that's just a kind of a general I mean, is there a specific maybe?
Well, I'm thinking for myself and then trying to imagine that for other people there are probably weightier kinds of matters about which trying to say to oneself, I don't know, is pretty tentative ground to be on. None of us know when we're going to die or when a loved one is going to have an accident or illness.
Right.
We really don't know really anything about the future.
Yes.
And it all seems very, like those kinds of things would have such a potential impact that it might be really difficult to embrace the I don't know point of view. Which is perhaps why, at least I think in this culture, there's so much attempt to keep those things, those kinds of content, either out of our minds or to build a false sense of knowledge about it.
Right. Well, we could say in a case where we really want to learn about things, we learn about things, but we can still have a very don't know attitude. We can be very open about what's in front of us. We have a body of knowledge about something, and you know, the more we relax and the more present we are, the more sort of, in an odd way, we draw on our body of knowledge. It comes out very spontaneously, but we're not missing what's in front of us. And many of life's most challenging situations, we don't know at all. Like, we don't know what it's like to attend to a dying person until we've done it. And so there's that whole thing of, like, you know, you're getting your first job, right? To get the job, you have to have experience. But you've never had a job before. It's like a catch-22. We're in that all the time. You know, we're going to be with a dying person. If we've never been with that person, the only way to get the experience is to have it when we don't know anything about it. And it can be such a relief to just not know what we don't know. We can still learn. We can be super motivated, you know, in order to help and benefit, to learn everything we can. But by definition, we're going to be in a ton of situations where we just don't know. And the more we can be okay about that, actually, really, it's often super helpful, you know, to not know and to just be really open to the situation. The not knowing can be deep curiosity and deep care. You cannot know how it's going to go for a person, but be really curious and really caring. That's the not knowing. You know, they're together. The knowing might be a real disconnect from the situation.
Possibility in the sense that what is known is fixed, you know, as opposed to there being more possibility than uncertainty. So I think this in relation to what is possible, even in terms of personal experience or even identity applied to identity. Being so certain about ourselves, what is possible for us or what our immutable attributes are.
The comment, and again, I'm just saying this for the mic, the comment is that when we know, there's fewer possibilities. I'm just very simple statement about what you said, but yeah, and probably many of you know the very famous quote from Suzuki Roshi, in the expert's mind, there are few possibilities. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. So you could really think of don't know mind as curiosity and openness. It's a very, very helpful way to be with others. Your cup is ready to have some new tea in it, tea you've never tasted before. Yes. Right.
How do you stay in the don't know when you're being paid for what it is that you are being asked to impart?
Right. Well, again, it depends on the context that you're in, but I mean, I used to be paid to be a scientist, and I was supposed to know a lot. But as scientists, we just speak in total probability and uncertainty, and you know, this is the best guess. So it's very accepted to speak in that kind of language. You know, I don't know in your work context if that is, but again, go back to that thing, the speech that doesn't contain uncertainty is not usually wise speech. So you're going to take your best guess. The expert doesn't know for sure, but the expert might be able to make a better guess than the person who's really new to the situation. So your language can contain a lot of uncertainty while it also contains knowledge. It's really just a quality of like, yeah, you know a body of knowledge. That's true. So you use that. But get it, that our knowledge, no matter how much you know, is still incredibly limited. So that we're really open to hearing something different. I mean, just for example, an atom, right? This the basic building block of the universe. Nobody knows what an atom is. No scientist has ever seen, quote unquote, seen an atom. We have a model for what there's a pattern of matter that we can make predictions about what matter will do, and those predictions, you know, often can be pretty accurate. So we don't know what's inside the black box, but we can say this can come, if this goes in, this will probably come out, and then it happens. But we don't know what an atom is. The more you study science, the more you see how massively uncertain it is. And yet, we have a body of knowledge that really is very skillful with the limits of our knowledge. We can still be sort of expert and not know very much. Is there a specific question, maybe related to your work, that you're supposed to know? I mean, what are you supposed to know? I would say it more like, I think this is the best guess. This is my best guess. I think this is the thing to try. Let's see what happens when we do this. I think this is really the best option. And let's see what happens. I'm not sure I'd want to say, let's try this, but I really don't know, you know? is that a hint?
Yeah. It seems like we can still know relative truth, though. Like, 2 + 2 = 4, as long as we know we're talking about math. So if we've set our field as something at work, there are things that are probably true within that, but on an ultimate scale, there's no 2s or 4s or any of that. So, yeah, okay.
Did everyone hear? Because I'm sure the mic picked that up. Yes, exactly. Relative truth is true, relatively. So if I had a big, huge bell here, right in this hand, and this bell here, this would be a small bell. If I had a little tiny baby bell, you know, the size of a thimble here, this would be a big bell. That's relatively true, right? Big bell, this is small. Little bell, this is big, right? It's relatively true. It's not intrinsically true, right? What's intrinsic to this is, you know, the hardness, the color, etc. But the relative truths are true, but only relatively. So 2 + 2 = 4 within a math sphere. So we don't want to the two truths are just as true. But the ultimate truth is true in all cases. Relative truth is only true sometimes in a relative framework. So we can be very intelligent about that and write, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. Yeah, that works, you know, every time. And maybe if we're in a quantum physics realm, you know, 2 + 2 doesn't equal 4. But as far as the rest of us are concerned, it does. So our limited knowledge is still knowledge, and it can be very useful. So we don't know mind doesn't mean just drop, you know, what we know relatively. We use it. It's useful. It's just not the truth in any ultimate sense. Okay. So stress reduction generally and don't know mind and how it relates to the holidays. So it takes getting used to, but to really start to be aware of uncertainty and allow uncertainty and accept uncertainty helps you be a lot happier, because it's really an opportunity to let go. And when you let go and you're not caught in all of your, oh my God, I have to figure that out, you know, it's kind of stressful to be there. When we just let go and be like, I just don't know right now. It really is a stress reduction principle. So if you want to stress less, accept that you just don't know. So we do this, don't we, a ton with other people. Oh my gosh, what does that person think of me? And we're imagining they're thinking something not so good. And yet we just don't know. Until we ask, until we check it out, if we're willing to check it out, we just don't know. That would be one really potent way to stress less, is to just be like, I just don't know. My sweetie and I are both extroverts. And sometimes when we speak, it's a little bit of ready, fire, aim. And we open our mouths, the words are already out, and there's no little unsend button that we can bring the words back in. No, and it's not in our email either, right? We don't have an unsend button. If only there was an unsend button. And so sometimes, you know, when we're hanging out with friends, and, you know, one of us might be wondering, like, oh, boy. You know, remember when I said that thing, blah, blah, blah? I really hope that was, I mean, they looked a little taken aback or whatever, you know. And then you check it out. And, I mean, literally, every now and then, actually, something did land the way I thought it landed. But I would say 9 out of 10. What? Wait, what? No, I don't even remember. What did you say? I don't have any clue. Do you have that experience? It's usually about us. It's just about our own projections. It is huge to just let go. Just not know until you check it out. And if you're really stressing about it, in a way, it's not helping. It's just making things worse for you. The only way to get through the situation is to ask. And if you're not willing to ask, then just be willing to don't know. Be willing to don't know. That's bad. Be willing to not know until you check it out. And if you're not going to check it out, then just don't know. This could be quite a practice to take into your holiday week next week. Just don't know until you're willing to ask. And if you're not willing to ask, then keep don't knowing. So stress reduction principle number one, be willing to not know what you don't know and really put it into practice. Take it into your life and see what happens when you just say to yourself, I just don't know. Just try it out. So here's a few don't know examples. This is from the News Digest The Week, March 2009. A California paraplegic who used a wheelchair for 20 years recovered his ability to walk after he was bitten by a spider. David Blankart, 48, was recently bitten by a venomous brown recluse spider and sent to an emergency room. A nurse noticed a muscle spasm in his paralyzed leg and tested him with an electric current. I yelled, he said. He had feeling in his leg. 5 days later, Blankart was walking. Doctors say they're mystified. So you're in a wheelchair, you're paraplegic, you can't feel your legs, and then on top of that, you got bit by a spider. Like, and then, boom, that's the thing that cures your paralysis. Who knew? Oh, this one didn't make it in. Oh, yeah. Okay, here's another one from the week. May 2009 in Washington State. A pilot's life was saved when his plane crashed into a field of portable toilets. You're upside down, you're in a plane, and you're heading for a field full of porta-potties. Oh my God, how bad could it get? The unnamed 67-year-old had just taken off from the airport in Puyallup, Washington, when the engine of a Cessna failed. Heading back to the runway, his plane struck a fence and crashed upside down into a field of honey buckets, portable restrooms. The honey buckets kind of cushion things, said a company official. So, we just don't know. So just enjoy, just be mystified, perplexed, like, huh, wonder how this is gonna be. I think I've used this example in here before, but someone new to meditation a few years ago came up to me so excited because they said, this was amazing. I was in my car. It was a snowy day. I was going to work. I was going up the hill on Highway 36, you know, just outside of Boulder. My car broke down on that snowy hill. I barely got the car, like, out of the rush hour traffic. And this is what I said to myself. This is interesting. That is don't know mind, and that's mindfulness. That's the curiosity and openness of don't know mind. This is the break we can give ourselves. This is going to be interesting. Okay, so principle number one to make your stress lighter and your holidays lighter, don't know what you don't know, and really take it to town. Principle two. Stay in the now. Of course, I'm going to say that. All stress is past or future. Stress rarely happens in the now. I mean, if you have a medical condition that's unfolding right now, that could probably be very stressful. But actually, if you think about it, your stress is about where's this going. The pain might be about right now, but the stress is about where's this going. This is interesting that I heard the spiritual teacher Byron Katie say when she was here in Boulder a few years back. In her work with torture survivors, the most stressful thing was not the torture itself. It was the fear of the torture. That was the thing that is most traumatizing, is their fear of it. The most stressful part of it. And that's future, based on past. Past and future are our stress. The more we're in the now, the less stressed we are. I know I've told this story, but it fits so well. I'm just going to tell it again, in case some of you haven't heard it. But Jack Kornfield and Ajahn Chah, the teacher I mentioned earlier, were walking along, and there was a big boulder out in the woods, and Ajahn Chah said to Jack, "Do you think that boulder's heavy?" Jack said, "Well, of course it's heavy. It's huge. It's really heavy." And Ajahn Chah said, "Not if you don't pick it up." That boulder is past and future. Past and future is very heavy. It's where all our stress is. We don't have to pick it up. We just don't. We can. or we can't, or we can choose not to. Either way. And this is what our practice is for. Our practice is about, it can be a little bit maybe like just not very exciting to come back again and again to the breath. Breath in, out, in, out. But really what it is this incredibly blessed neutrality, this blessed break from all of our stress. If we can actually really just rest with rise of the belly, fall of the belly, rise of the belly, fall of the belly, we get very satisfied in a way that's restful. So the more we're in the now, the less stressed we are. Here's what we need to do. Of course, we need to be mindful. But we also need to remember, when we're caught in past thinking, to remind ourselves that we're in the past. And then there's some choice. Huh? Am I going to keep going with this remorse? Or is this like the 69th time? Maybe I could let go on the 70th, you know? Here's what Aldous Huxley says about living in the past. Chronic remorse is a most undesirable thing. If you have behaved badly, repent. Make what amends you can and address yourself to the task of behaving better next time. On no account brood over your wrongdoing. Rolling in the muck is not the best way of getting clean. So, living in the now means being willing to let the past reside where it belongs, which is in the past. But guess what? There's no such thing as the past. The past is a creation of mind, period. The past is gone. The only way the past exists is if you conjure it up in your thoughts. It does not exist. Yesterday is as gone as a million years ago. It does not exist. When we're in past, it's because we're thinking and conjuring it up. This is huge to remember. Huge. So the same is true of the future. Let the future lie in the future, which, oh, that's where it doesn't exist. The future does not exist. It only exists if you're thinking about it. It has no existence whatsoever. The future is as gone as a million years ago or a million years from now. It's as non-existent as that. It only exists as a thought. So to sum this all up, this is principle number two. What's done is done. It is what it is, and que sera, sera. That's the simple summary of how to relate to time. What's gone is gone. What's here right now is how it is. And whatever will be, will be. This is stress reduction number two. Okay, and this might be relevant to the holidays, principle number three. Let other people not know what they don't know about you. Do you find that you change your opinion about yourself because of someone else's opinion of you? Just a little example from today. I strained my calf about 10 days ago, and this is playing soccer, and this is my last chance to play soccer before I'm gone next week. So I said, I'm going to go out anyway and play a little today. I think I'm going to be fine. And about 10 minutes in, I'm feeling it. But I keep playing. and I was just, you know, very ineffective out there because I could hardly run very well. And then when we ended, we played today with some really good guy that's just pickup, and I think he'd played for an MLS one team once. And so we're standing there, and, you know, me and a friend, and I say to this guy, it was great playing with you. And he's like, yeah. And he looks at this other guy, and he says, you were making amazing runs today. And he's looking right at the other guy, and I'm standing there like, yep, and I wasn't, right? Is that what you're saying? I mean, it was so funny. I just could barely run. So anyway, but it's like, he doesn't know me. He doesn't have a clue. He doesn't know my calf was injured. So I know me. I know, you know, I'm a lot more effective out there than another day. So be willing to let other people not know what they don't know. They don't know about you. But they might have opinions about you. That has nothing to do with you. That's just about them. So another way to negotiate your social interactions. This can be really true, can it, with our parents, who often have no clue about us. Just let them not know. They don't know. They might have an opinion, but that doesn't mean they know. Don't let their opinion influence your opinion. Anyone want to comment on that? Otherwise, I'll move on to a fourth point.
I just read an expression of that I liked a lot last night. An article I was reading, someone referenced Wayne Dyer as having said, what other people think of me is none of my business.
There you go. Exactly. Because it's about them. It's not about you. It's about them. Their values, their criteria, their assumptions, their projections. You know about you. Okay. So the fourth principle, it's one thing to remind yourself, you know, what's done is done, que sera, sera. But if you're going to turn away from past and future, what are you going to turn towards? So, of course, we turn towards the present moment with our mindfulness practice, with our awareness. So it's hard to just, like, let go of your thoughts, right? It's much easier to pay attention to something. So get in the now. If you're noticing your body, you're in the present moment. If you're noticing sound, you're in the present moment. If you're noticing that you're seeing, you're in the present moment, you're in the now. This is the place where when you live here deeply enough, there's no stress. Stress doesn't happen here. There's just seeing, there's just knowing. It might be unpleasant, but unpleasant doesn't have to be stressful. It might be pleasant, and that doesn't have to be stressful. It's just is.
Peter,
yes.
Please.
One
of the things that stresses me out is having to make decisions on the spot.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I don't have the information.
Right.
And that is in the present, or at least can be in the present, very stressful.
Yes.
Can you speak to that?
The question is about having to make decisions in the now. When we just don't know. This is again where we have to remember this is the human condition. We're all in this together, right? We're all having to do this all the time, make decisions where we just don't know. So we just say, oh my gosh, here I go. This is what I'm gonna do, and let's see what happens. But I forgive myself in advance. Because I'm just taking my best shot, and I'm so human. We need to say that to ourselves, because it's not often going to be what other people are going to say to us.
But let's say the stakes are high. So let's say your child has
a
fever, and the doctor says,
yes,
we need to do this risky surgery. I mean, but there's no way not to be stressed by that.
Of course.
Whatever happens, happens.
Right.
Right. So I guess... Yeah.
So this is really important. The way to stress less is to not stress about stress and not think, well, because you meditate, that you're never going to stress. You are going to stress. That's damn stressful. So just stress. Don't stress about the stress. That's what you can do. Don't add extra. Don't, like, come in with a bunch of judgments. I meditate now. I shouldn't be feeling this way. If you're feeling that way, you should be feeling that way. because that's the way you're feeling. Just like a cloud is a cloud. We don't say, what's that cloud doing in the sky? You know, that cloud is wrong. But we say that about our stress and our feelings all the time. But the cloud should be in the sky because it is in the sky. And if you're stressed about that decision, then that's what you should be. So that's one thing. We need to really accept our situation, but it doesn't mean we have to believe it. We can accept that we're stressed, but the thoughts around it are often extremely uncertain and limited. And it is absolutely a risk to be a parent and have to make a decision, you know, day in, day out. I mean, we all know that as parents. So there's no way out of it. Don't stress about stress. Just say, if you notice you're stressed, say, of course. That's the first thing to say to yourself. Of course I'm stressed. And then when your thoughts are like, oh my God, no. Then what you say to that is, we'll see. These are actually, this is the, if I could boil it down on how to be wise with our emotional life, these are the two phrases we need most. We need to say, of course, so that we stop struggling with it. We just let ourselves be stressed when we stress. So we really accept the fact of our stress, but what we don't need to accept is the truth of our thoughts. Our thoughts are often so wrong. So just say, we'll see. We'll see. And you take your best shot, and that is just... And every parent knows about making mistakes with their kids, big time. Are you a parent? I'm not either. So here we are. But, you know... I'm a very devoted uncle, so I see my brother all the time.
Veterinary emergencies.
You deal with veterinary emergencies?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's life or death consequences, and good for you. Are you a vet?
No, no.
Oh, with your, got it. So. Imagine being a heart surgeon, dealing with life and death, like just routinely twice a day, or... I mean, my God. But it's really helpful to give yourself a large, large break. And yes, our actions have consequences and our mistakes have consequences. And it's so human to cause harm when you were just doing your best. And it hurts. It really hurts. And we can... allow that and forgive ourselves as we go. We could say mindfulness is continuous self-forgiveness. We just keep, yep, that one, mm-hmm, that one, mm-hmm, that one, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We all know this from watching our minds, right? It isn't pretty, is it? What goes through your mind in a 30-minute sit? We're all so, you know, down deep, so vulnerable and insecure and flawed. And we need to make our hearts a big, wide, open space for that. Because it's true. And we're all in this, we're all doing it together. I don't care how good you look. So, I don't know.
But, I mean, the of course, and we'll see, that fits.
Good.
Feels like valuable response.
Good. Again, and this relates to the talk I gave a few weeks ago. It's freedom right here, right now, with our stress or our remorse or our joy. We can wake up right now. We don't have to be any way other than we are in order to wake up and be in our experience. And we can be very mindful. We can start with "of course" and continue with "we'll see." Those two things really sum up our mindfulness. We need to really allow it and be curious about it and not get carried away at the same time by the story we're telling ourselves. So that's our mindfulness practice. So, oof. There's so much more here. But let's just do something experiential really briefly now. If you would, bring up something in your life that's difficult, that's also uncertain. So notice your breath as you're bringing this to mind. Maybe even just let go for a moment of this difficulty. Just feel your breath right now. And then come back to now, bring the difficulty back to mind. And bring up what you don't know. What's uncertain about this? And now see what happens if you say this to yourself. I just don't know. And then bring your attention back to your breath. Let go of this scenario as much as you can. Just feel the rise and fall of belly or chest or in out at the nostrils. Give yourself complete permission to leave that situation. Really feel your breath, beginning, middle, and end of an in-breath, beginning, middle, and end of an out-breath. And notice if there's a gap between. Just relax and soften. So if anyone cares to share, what happened when you said, I just don't know?
I felt free.
Free? Anyone else? You could just say one word.
Ease.
Unburdened.
Mm-hmm. I felt like it was something that I could know more about if I worked on it.
Uh-huh.
So just letting it go now without doing more work to try to get a better answer felt a little bit like copying out.
Sort of premature letting go.
Right.
Right. And of course there are times when that's when we can really get that, oh, actually, you know, thinking about this could really be useful, so I'm going to do that. If you're really sitting down for meditation, I wouldn't recommend that because, you know, that's not the intention. But yeah, we have that all the time where, yeah, actually, I'm going to complete this because I think I'm going to get somewhere with it. But It's also to be honest with ourselves when we've done that like 64 times and not, you know, we no light came from it. then we can let go. Was for anyone, was it just like didn't really make a difference to say that? Just one?
Well, I have to find out, so it's kind of like...
Oh, okay.
It's like I don't know, my mind immediately said, we better figure it out.
Oh, so. Yeah. Do you have to find out right now?
No, that's the next thing. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. See, that there are things where, yeah, we're going to have to know. But the thing is, again, we can take the steps to know something, you know, and get there, especially if we have to know, you know. But, you know, sometimes we can just really trust that we'll get there. We can let go because we'll get there. We'll actually get that knowledge when it's time, you know, because we can obsess about not knowing because we're very anxious about how that might be, but really we don't have any clue. So sometimes, even on something where we need to know, we can give ourselves the break and we can say future thinking, you know. That's one way to really let go, is to remind yourself, I'm in the future. Say future thinking, come back.
So. When I did that, I got this really spacious sort of sensation, because when I was focusing on, you know, the situation, something that I had some worry about, it seemed to be just naturally associated with that, some speculation about how this is probably going to turn out. And then by contrast, you know, doing that, disregarding it from, I don't know, you know, it's much less defined, just sort of like relaxing into this kind of like spacious sense of this countless possibilities of the way that it could turn out.
Right, right. So when our thinking can help us like learn, it's useful. But when it's a situation like that where really it's just anything could happen, our thinking about it, we can get obsessive about it, but our thinking about it isn't going to teach us anything, you know? It can be such a relief in that situation to just let go.
But what if it's like paying bills? Like, you can't just let go.
You can pay the bill, and that's taking care of it. You don't have to stress about it. It's this. It's a bracketing thing. When it's time to do something about it, do something about it. But if we obsess about that 24/7 all the time, we drive ourselves crazy. It's a huge stressful. We make something that's difficult much more difficult. If it's constructive thinking and it helps us problem solve and helps us come up with an idea where we can address the situation, great. But a lot of times, we're just on autopilot, needlessly just running through all the problems, you know, umpteen times. And it, you know, some of the research shows that people who ruminate, who kind of obsessively run over situations in their mind, they never get out of the thought loops. It actually creates passivity instead of action. So one trick with stress is to bracket. So if you're doing something now, like you're at the gym, or you're with your kid, or whatever, you just say, you know, I'm actually not here right now to solve that bill problem. I'm here to enjoy my child, or I'm here to get a workout. And we can bracket it. We can say, not now, to ourselves. And then we can deal with it when it's time. And that's a really important stress management thing, is to not be obsessing about it 24/7. Because that's just making it way worse than it is. We all have problems. And, you know. And when you're at the gym, when you've made, you know, that intention to yourself to not go there right now, then just note future thinking when you do. And that'll help you come back. The last little thing I want to say, and then we'll just end with a few minutes sitting. The other thing you can do in the holidays, just to reduce stress less, is to send love to people that you're around. It can be very interesting. If you're with family and you don't connect well with your family, like you just don't have the same values, you can't be real, you can still love them privately. It can be very nice. And this we have to do as parents. I'm saying we. Again, I'm a very active uncle. We can love our kids endlessly on our meditation cushion. They cannot stop us. How we want to interact with them, they will be very clear about how they want to be loved. But we can wish them well to our heart's desire. Nobody can stop you. So you can just love your relatives, your family, your peeps as much as you want in your meditation. Send them loving kindness. May you be happy. May you have ease of well-being. This can be to that, you know, crotchety uncle who's super conservative and you don't share his values. But he's family. You know, he's your mother's brother. And you can still love him, even if you don't talk to him, even if you, like, ignore him. You know, send him love. Send him wishes. Because even though you might not agree with him, you probably want him to be happy, don't you? It'll really help you just deal with your family if you're doing that just on your own. So that's my last little recommendation. And it can be really nice to do that. So let's just sit for a couple minutes.